Hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of the Michael and Patty Show, coming to you from the Charlottetown waterfront, looking out on the yacht club. How's Patty today?
Good morning, Michael. I'm doing very well, and it's a little bit of a, I guess, windy day here where you can see white caps out on the harbor, which is kind of cool and something I always love seeing.
One of the questions that was always asked to me when I moved here is, what is the difference between the weather in Ontario? I'm from southern Ontario. You're from way, way, way up north. And I usually tell them, number one, you're going to get higher winds. Number two, I think you're going to get a lot more sunnier days in comparison to, say, the Hamilton to Toronto area, which is subjected to the cloud effect. Clouds for months and months and months between probably December and April or so, it's pretty drizzly and depressing, I found. I don't know about up north.
As north as I am from, I'm from Cambridge, which is approximately 40 minutes north of Hamilton, and that does not constitute north in Ontario standards. But yes, the difference, the only difference I really find between the weather in southern Ontario and, say, Prince Edward Island is we do have a little bit higher winds, more sunny days, though, and I just think
more snow.
A little bit more snow.
But
we don't
deal
have the
with
ice.
It better.
Yes, we do deal. We have the infrastructure. Everyone knows what to do with the snow here.
Well, you've got the farmers, which are good enough to be doing snow removal in the winter, and you don't have that in southern Ontario or up north. Usually you're hiring subcontractors, and there's just not enough of them.
Yeah, usually the cities look after their own crews in that for snow removal. And
let's talk stats. I wasn't going to bring this up, but I did happen to look at our Google stats, and these are stats only and specifically from Google and no other sources. So since March, when I started actually looking at how many new viewers were coming to the podcast, amazingly enough, we had 2,419 new people visit the podcast as a result of a Google search since March 1st, today being June the 1st. So I thought that was pretty good. March, April, May, June, 3 months.
It does sound like pretty good numbers.
And in the last 30 days, guess how many new visitors we had?
I have no idea.
955. So what amazes me the most is there's that many people looking for Prince Edward Island real estate. When I lived in Ontario, I can count on zero fingers how many times people mentioned Prince Edward Island. Everybody mentioned Nova Scotia because they do a great job of marketing that province, but no one ever mentioned PEI. What about you?
No, I never really heard. I mean, I knew Prince Edward Island existed because once a year in geography class, they, as you're naming all the provinces, that was part of the test. But other than that, just not a province that really ever got mentioned.
Getting to the real estate stats here, which we usually get probably on a 2-3 week delay.
Yes.
And as I said, this is June the 1st, so we've got the April stats here. And what they're saying is home sales are up 4%. Home sales numbered 184 units in April. 25 up 4% compared to 177 in April 24.
And the market balance, at the end of April, the market was well balanced, favoring neither the buyers nor sellers. However, you have to look more hyperlocal. This is just speaking about the island as a whole.
Right. And the island has many different markets. And it has not only different markets as far as location, but it has different markets as far as, this recreational, is this a vacation property, or is this something more utilitarian that you're going to find in, say, Summerside or Charlottetown that someone's buying to go back and forth to work?
Yeah, and even within cities or towns, there are certain subdivisions or areas getting into micro markets that are more sought after than others. So when we reference or speak of the stats, it is talking about the island as a whole.
New listings up 5.1%. There's 389 new listings added in April 2025, up 5.1% compared to 370 in April 2024. And the benchmark price, which is something the Canadian Real Estate Association developed, which is supposed to be your typical residential dwelling, What does it say, Patty?
The average or the benchmark price is $364,700, again, for the island tip-to-tip.
Perfect. And if you do want up-to-date stats, check out the Canadian Real Estate Association. And the other place I would go is probably Canadian Home Mortgage Corporation, CMHC.
Yeah, and just know that what $364,000 can get you in different locations across the island may look a little different. So something to keep in mind.
And speaking a little bit more about stats, if we go into Ontario, a house in April of 25 would be $715,500. That's crazy. Hamilton, $782,900. And what would another market be? Niagara's always been pretty good. Niagara Region, $603,000.
Yeah, the 715 in Cambridge, I know that would be a semi is what that would get you, not a single-family detached home, because I know my brother's home is worth approximately that, and that's what he owns, with a garage and a pool.
And then you get into BC, and usually they're the most expensive. Greater Vancouver is $1.164 million.
Wow.
Getting to the Maritimes, Nova Scotia, $417 million. PEI, we just discussed, around $368 million. Newfoundland, which really don't hear a lot of about as far as them being a competitor, but St. John's, $373,000. So they're pretty close to where we are. Getting into other topics on our podcast, we'll talk about your septic story and how it pays to make sure things are documented. I guess the main question would be, is if a seller is ordered to replace the septic system existing of the weeping tile bed and potentially the septic tank, are they required to level, landscape, put sod down, plant some trees? How did that work out for you? Explain the situation and how we cannot mess this up if we're asking for things to be done prior to close. And if I may put a footnote on that, I would probably try to never do that. I would just ask for cash adjustment, because you're going to get into the situation what Patty is going to tell us about here.
Yeah, and it just depends on what side of the transaction you are on. If you're representing the seller, it would just be best to do an adjustment on price if you're able to, and say the insurance company and the lender would go ahead and provide insurance and financing for the property. However, if you're on the buyer's side, and you would like to have a nice package for your client at closing, and you'd like to see if you can negotiate the work to be completed so that your buyer doesn't have to deal with it. The other benefit is if the cost is a little more than what was forecasted or predicted, well, guess what? In order for that to close, the seller is going to have to eat that additional cost. So what ended up happening in my office, and we're still in the midst of dealing with this, so I guess stay tuned. However, we're representing the buyer, our office is representing the buyer, and within the contract, the clause as it was written was that the seller was going to be responsible for the replacement of the septic system. Obviously, it came up as an issue as a result of this septic inspection, which was a clause and is a clause in our standard Schedule A purchase and sale agreements. So good that the agent put that in to protect the buyer. It needed to be replaced. They ended up doing a clause within an amendment, would be my guess. I haven't seen the documentation or paperwork on this. Just stating that the seller agrees to replace the septic system prior to closing at seller's expense would be how I would assume the clause is written. And that's just a very basic. There is obviously more needed within that clause. However, fast forward, closing is supposed to happen. They needed to do another perk test in order to do the septic. The septic company wouldn't put it in unless all these steps were done, which is taking a little more time. And at this time of year, we're also at the mercy of the weather, and septic, the perk tests don't typically get done until closer to, again, depending on the weather that we've had for that year, until the end of May. So timing was a little tight with this. The septic is not completed. They just finished the perk test. And now the question has been, that has risen, was the who's responsible for the landscaping. The septic company has informed the buyer that this is going to possibly cost another couple thousand dollars, to which now the buyer is saying, well, I want the seller to cover this cost. And technically, it wasn't written within the contract, although we've had a really interesting conversation, Michael, about it. Michael feels that it should be just a given. My position, especially if I was representing the seller, would be, well, I replaced the septic. Obviously, we're going to cover it with earth, but nowhere did I say, my seller was responsible or agreed to make sure that there's grass and everything there. So it was a little bit of a discussion, and it is with the lawyers right now, and they're talking it out. But the point of this is you need a very detailed clause. It's no different than new builds. You need to outline what is expected of this property. Is it going to be seeded? Is it going to be sodded? Is everything going to be leveled? Are there going to be walkways? Is someone going to come back? Because as a septic system starts to settle, the earth settles, you're going to end up with a dip there where the tank is located and situated. So regardless, the buyers are going to have to do some additional landscaping down the road and level off the property. But detailed clauses are so, so important. And a good clause consists of five components.
The best thing you can do here is just ask for cash adjustment. Just acknowledge the fact that the septic system has an issue and you want an adjustment, saying for $10,000 or $15,000, and just be done with it. Otherwise, you do get into this circus. And unless your clause is written airtight, and that can be sometimes, or it is, it's always very hard to do, to predict what's going to happen, because you could get down to who's installing the system. Where's the system going? Do we get a drawing of the system? What kind of tank are they using? What is the capacity of the tank? Does it have one lid or two lids? Do they put grass seed down? Do they just leave it as dirt? Do they level it? Do they put sod down? Are they responsible for watering the sod? I mean, the list goes on and on and on. Easier just to do a cash adjustment. However, you do end up assuming the risk that it may cost more than they say, but if you're getting the vendor to do it, you have to assume the vendor is probably going to do the least expensive job they possibly can. And that could get right in even soil. Rather than bringing in clean fill, they bring in dirt from down the street and you got a field of weeds.
Yeah, and do they just put in a bunch of island soil, or do they actually put topsoil to make sure that the seed and the grass takes? So there's a lot involved in, and again, it was just an example of the importance of writing a very detailed clause. If you're a buyer and you have representation, that's the whole purpose of this podcast, is to educate the consumer out there to make sure that you're able to advocate.
And the other thing is, in your clause, you just don't have in there what they need to do. You also have to have in there what happens if they don't do it and by when.
Yes.
You said there was five key things to an offer. Do you remember what those are, or I guess a condition?
A good clause. What is to be done? When is it to be done by? Who is to pay for it? Who is responsible to do? Okay, what's to be done?
You got it.
And what happens if it's not completed? So what's to be done? Who's to do it? Who's to pay for it? When is it to be done by? And what happens if it is not completed?
Well covered.
Yes. And again, it just helps the lawyers represent that client far better if the clause is written well. I see too many times where it's, this is to be done by this date by the seller, and at the seller's expense. But no one says what happens if it's not completed. It just gets dumped on the lawyer's lap, and now they have to deal with and battle back and forth, which causes additional cost to both parties, the buyer and the seller. So make sure your clause, if you're a buyer or a seller listening to this, make sure your clause has those five components. I'd write them down and keep a little log on some of the important tidbits that we share.
Moving along, have you ever seen in a subdivision or location on the island where they sort of create their own market by having a high sale?
I guess so.
I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
So I'm out in this subdivision. It's cottages. Some of them are year-round homes now. There's vacant lots still for sale, even though the subdivision started in the 80s. And the people I showed a property to say, these lots are worth about $260,000. And I'm thinking to myself, and I didn't say this to them, I'm thinking that sounds really high. When I ran the data showed me that all the sales in that subdivision for waterfront lots ranged between about 125,000, which is the last one I sold in there, to about $154,000. But somebody listed a lot for $298,000.
Was that two lots together?
They listed a lot for $298,000 and it sold for $260,000. So somebody paid a lot of money for that lot because they probably, and this is our other market in PEI, it's recreational, people are buying an emotion. So somebody else listed a lot figuring, well, that just sold for $260,000. Mine's got to be worth $250,000. So it sold for $250,000. So now you got two sales out of 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, or 12. The other 12 were between 125,000, 154,000. So what they've actually done is they've created their own market. So be careful when purchasing something that you're not overpaying, because down the road, people are probably going to look at these stats and they're going to say, well, here's two guys that paid 250, 260, but everybody else paid 125,000, 154,000. That is more reasonable to think that that's market value than the two outliers. In fact, when you do a CMA or an appraisal, usually what you do is you remove the outliers. The data on the bottom is usually those motivated sellers, foreclosures, whatever, bank sales. And then on the top, you have people paying way too much, probably based on emotion.
Yes, which is why it's important to know what the median number is, because that will...
Opposed to the average.
Opposed to the average number. And ask for the data. If you're a buyer looking at these properties, now a seller can ask whatever they want. It doesn't mean that is what the property is worth. If you're planning on keeping the property, that seems very inflated. But if you're planning on keeping the property for the next 10 plus years and you pay a little more than market value, it all works out because it may end up being at that price in the next couple years. However, if you are looking, in this case, land, you could be sitting on that piece of land for 20 years if the market corrects itself or buyers end up educating and sobering up and you want to sell it now to get your recoup your costs because your plans changed and you want to do something else with those funds, you might be sitting on it for a while.
As I said, the subdivision's been around since the mid-80s and there's still lots for sale 45 years later. So, and I know one lot that's on the water there, and it's in and around that 150, 160. It's been on the market for as long as I can remember, probably for at least last 5 to 8 years, which is ridiculous, but it happens. I mean, there's no liquidity in land sometimes on the island. Getting on with another conversation. This is new. I've never seen this happen on the island. The agents and brokers have the ability to have their own business plans and charge whatever fees they want to charge for whatever services they're offering. But in this particular instance, I found it interesting that somebody I was referring business to was turned down because this particular buyer found an agent that was willing to refund 20% of his commission back to the buyer. Now, without getting into whether or not that's even legal, depending on how you phrase it or call it or how that's going to be paid, and whether there's HST applicable or does the buyer have to pay income tax or capital gains on that, we're not going to worry about that.
Or if it was multiple offer situation as well.
What do you mean?
Well, if it's a multiple offer and that buyer's, well, I guess it's just the buyer's agent. It's not the seller's agent that's
correct.
Giving
so
back
what,
the funds.
This is a new agent.
Yep.
That's basically rebating 20% of their commission.
Yep.
So just do the math here. You've got an agent that's probably on anywhere between a 50-50 to 90-10 split. So there's anywhere between 50% and 10% of that gross commission going to the broker. And then they're going to give away another 20% to the buyer.
Mm.
What are your thoughts on this?
again, they can do whatever they want. My only thing that I will say on this is if an agent, if a realtor, a real estate professional knows their value and they know what they bring to the table, they may be less, and well-educated, they may be less inclined to give away a part of lawyers at closing. Don't say, well, I'm going to give you back X amount of dollars, at least not that I'm aware of. I really feel this person doesn't sound like they've got the education behind them to understand what they really brought to the table.
I think if I was looking for property in an area on earth, my biggest concern would be that I'm dealing with an agent or a broker that's highly experienced. What we've defined as an expert is someone that has 10,000 hours of experience, which is basically 5 years full-time, 40 hours a week, and has also done at least 1,000 transactions in the market. And this is the crucial part, because you see this in Ontario all the time and other provinces where agents are working from Niagara Falls to Oshawa. I mean, how can they be an expert in everything? They can't. I would rather have an agent that knows the market I'm looking at inside out, in as much that, well, you know as well as I do, you go into a city and you don't want to be on this street, or don't be west of this street, or you need to be east of this street. Like a block one way or the other can be a difference between a good investment and a bad investment, or a house that's difficult to sell or is not going to give you a higher return just because you're two blocks away from a street that has a bad name. So I would be more concerned about dealing with an expert and getting good advice, and specifically someone that has credentials and is able to negotiate for you hard if they're representing solely you and you're not into dual agency and all that sort of stuff. But even this guy, and he's from Ontario, says, we spoke to an agent, offers 20% rebate, and he says it's not a big number, but then he's asking the agent to match that. And the agent said, no, I'm not interested. It's not my business plan. But even the buyer's thinking it's not a big deal. But I think in this particular case, he was probably penny wise and pound foolish, thinking he's saving, in his words, a couple $1,000s, but probably losing out on 10 or 20 or 30 because he's overpaying or not negotiating a deal on the property he's buying.
Yeah, the agent may not be educated enough to get them that deal, or like you had mentioned in your example, protecting them to ensure that whatever they do purchase is in an area that they could end up seeing a possible return in years to come. Save a few thousand today may cost you tens of thousands in the future.
And it goes without saying, if you're dealing with somebody that is not an expert, that doesn't have the experience, those contracts, just as we discussed with the septic system, may not be very well written. And that's going to turn into a lot of headaches and potentially cost. Moving along, and this is a conversation or topic you brought up a few weeks ago. Agents writing contracts without IRAC approval or Canadian residency prohibition requirements met.
Yeah, so no matter where the buyer is originally from, even if they're Canadian or an island resident, if the property that they're purchasing is in within the amalgamation area,
well, if they're residents,
they still have to sign.
They still have to sign.
Yeah, they still have to sign the certificate stating that they are in compliance and that they understand and acknowledge these are, where if the property is in within this prohibition area, which is in place for at least the next year, that they don't fall into the criteria or the area that prohibits them from purchasing it. So it doesn't matter, because the seller is not aware of whether this name that's on the contract is a island resident or a Canadian or a permanent resident. They're not aware. So by including that document, it lets them know, I'm legally allowed to sell this property to this person because they comply and they're legally allowed to purchase it, which is why it's so important. The other thing is IRAC. Now, there's new IRAC regulation that's coming down, possibly, it sounds like maybe September, but I'm not going to get into that. You really, if you're a buyer listening to this and you already have a land holdings on Prince Edward Island, you need to make sure that you're not exceeding the allotted amount, which is 5 acres of land or 165 feet of water frontage per household, is how it is documented or required. As much as it is, yes, a realtor's hopefully responsibility to provide guidance and support, if you're getting a discounted agent that, as our example before, they may not be knowledgeable in that area, which is some of the areas that could end up costing you money. However, as long as you are, as a consumer, educated and you know to ask the right questions, if you're a realtor listening to this, make sure you ask or do your due diligence. It's all about proper questions, making sure your documentation is in place, because this, if a seller hasn't agreed to allow you an IRAC clause within the contract agreement and you forgot to write it in, will create a bit of a messy situation.
Bottom line is, if you're a non-resident or you're even a PEI corporation, you may have to go through IRAC, so make sure you're aware of that. All the information on that is under irac.pe.ca. And make sure that if you're a non-Canadian resident, that you're allowed to buy in that area that you're thinking of purchasing, and that applies to all of Canada, and the maps are generated by Census Canada, and then the Canadian Real Estate Association has them online, I believe, going by memory.
Yes, each area, each association across Canada would have their areas. And again, just a lot of our information that we provide, yes, it's hyperlocal to Prince Edward Island, but this prohibition is across Canada. In those areas, there is an added document that should be part of the contract agreement.
Simple topic. I'm coming to the island. I arrive. I want maps, magazines. I want to know what there is to do on the island, what tourist attractions there are, restaurants to visit, all that sort of stuff. What is the best place to find that on the island, in your opinion?
Well, in Charlottetown, the best place to go is Founders Hall. It has, they've got a few walls. They're nicely, you know, separated based on the different areas of the island, you know, whether it's Prince County, Queen County, Kings County is how our island is divided. It has great activities, different tourist magazines, certificates and stuff, or coupons in different areas. If you're a buyer looking to relocate to PEI, you could always ask your agent, while you're planning your house hunting trip, could you send me a few brochures or some information just so that you can get the most out of your trip here? It's nice to have a little bit of downtime when you've been looking at houses all day to just really, you know, again, enjoy everything that PEI has to offer. Because I find once you end up moving here and you're a resident, because I've been through this, you get caught up in the hustle and bustle of work and, you know, looking after your home and your family. So it's kind of nice to take advantage of those little opportunities. But Founders Hall has some great brochures covering every activity imaginable.
And they're located next to the cruise ship terminal. And the cruise ship terminal actually has a whole shopping area there as well that's opened up when the cruise ships are in port. And if you want to know when the cruise ships are in port, you can follow on Twitter the Twitter feed for, is it the Atlantic Cruise Port something or other? Yeah. I know there's the Charlottetown Port that they announce it. And then there's the Atlantic Cruise Association or Cruising Association, which announces the cruise ships where they're going in the Maritimes. But there's a couple Twitter feeds you can subscribe to that will tell you when the cruise ships are in port. And then they'll open up the cruise ship terminal as well for the public, regardless of whether you're cruising or not.
Yeah. And they're in there again, down at Peaks Key as well. Just a bunch of nice tourist items, little mementos, things that you can send home to your family or bring home after your vacation.
You're selling a house. You ask the seller for all the documents they have. Specifically, you're asking them for a receipt for their septic pumping and inspection, which is done all the time here in PEI at frequencies that the septic people or statistics or the government tell you to pump your tank at. But what happens is when someone goes to buy, they may have a clause to inspect or pump the tank. But if it was just done a month or two ago, if you can provide a receipt, that would be really helpful. Here's the problem. A lot of times they're paying in cash and there's no receipt. So if you're going to have your septic tank pumped and inspected, make sure you get a receipt, specifically if you're going to sell the house. Would you agree?
Yes, because we shouldn't be evading paying taxes. However, just know that the receipt, based on an experience that I've just recently had, may not be enough to validate that the septic system has been deemed operational and serviceable going forward. We've had one where the septic was apparently pumped. There was no receipt, no documentation. And unfortunately, verbally, and no one will put this in writing for us, that the septic was not, it didn't, the septic company did not feel that the septic system was working properly, but they didn't want to document it, and that they felt maybe the leach bed was obstructed or blocked. It could be something as serious as tree roots that are growing and, you know, invading the tile bed. There could be other blocks that, you know, ended up inside of it. Regardless, make sure that the receipt states that it is deemed serviceable going forward. If not, I highly recommend, if you're a buyer listening to this, to get your own septic inspection done for your peace of mind, because they're quite costly. As much as you were saying, you know, around $10,000 or so, I'm going to let you know the quote.
I just picked that number hypothetically. Yeah. It's probably going to be more than that.
Definitely going to be more. What was quoted to the buyers for the situation, the story we were talking about at the beginning, was around $15,000 to $20,000, because they have to do the removal and everything of the existing septic system, and the landscaping, which is what bumped it over the $20,000 mark. So just know that it's a very costly, for the sake of $500 or less than probably, but a septic inspection, look how much you could be potentially saving yourself down the road.
And when you mentioned the perk test or percolation test, that comes in usually category 1, 2, or 3. Anything over 3, you probably don't want to touch. In fact, even category 3, probably you don't want to touch, because it's probably going to be even more than that, potentially double if it's category 3, because now you're getting into engineered systems and lift stations and electrical and hiring electricians and all kinds of stuff there. Moving along, secret source for listings. Everyone always seems to think there's this secret source. I want that house that's not advertised in MLS, the secret listing. Is there a secret source for listings?
No, there's not.
Well, there is and there isn't. Number one, you do have people that are typically not very motivated to sell that will tell an agent, well, if a buyer comes along, you can mention my house. That's referred to as a pocket listing. The other thing you do have is you do have listings that agents have canceled, withdrawn, they've expired. And in those cases, if you happen to trip across these as a buyer's agent, reach out to the listing agent and say, that listing that's expired, withdrawn, or expired, withdrawn, expired, or canceled, can you get that back, or are they still interested in selling, right?
Yeah, well, that situation, again, we are not allowed to use our MLS database as a source to look for listings. Now, if you have a buyer, and the value of having a very good buyer's agent who you've seen everything that's online, nothing is of interest. If you're not specific to, I need to be in this city or this area, where your agent can perhaps go door knock, you know, a similar style property or home that you're looking for, you can comb through, again, the listings that you had mentioned that are expired, canceled, or withdrawn, just to see if any of those may be what your client's looking for. And best practice, in my opinion, is just to reach out to that agent and say, you know, the situation, did they pull it because, you know, they had some work to do or the timing wasn't right and they had plans on bringing it back on in the fall? I may have a buyer for it. So again, that's the whole reason why we would be diving into these expired, canceled, or withdrawn. It's typically if you already have a buyer looking and you can't find anything.
Let's talk about condominiums just briefly. We've covered this in depth on previous episodes, but essentially what I want to cover here is I have had a couple inquiries on condos recently. I'm sure you have as well.
No, not recently.
Just even last week. And the one thing that always comes to mind to me is condos are kind of new in PEI, and you're basically buying into a business or a company that's running a building, and you're typically sharing those costs with the building. It's like any business you're buying into or anything you're investing in, it comes down to how well managed that condo association is. Unfortunately, in PEI, we really don't have a lot of government oversight. We don't have a lot of audits happening and third parties going through the books in these condos associations to make sure everything is 100%. So when you buy into these condo associations, be careful and make sure you know the numbers and the story behind that condo, because you may be buying into a business that may cost you some money. Giving you an example, we buy into a three-story apartment. It's all condos and all the siding falls off. The windows need replacing and the roof blew off in Fiona and the insurance didn't cover it. Well, now that expense is the responsibility of the condo corporation, which may or may not have any money in the bank, depending on how they run that condo corporation. In fact, they probably should have had it insured properly to begin with, but these are things to be careful about when you're buying a condo, not just in PEI, but anywhere. And there is a big list of documents you should be asking for, but unless you're aware of what these documents mean and what the numbers should be, they're probably not going to be helpful. So you probably want to have someone that's a condo expert to take a look at them.
Yeah, and know who the internal infrastructure of the management looking after the funds. Because if you have somebody who has direct control of, you know, it's the reserve fund is typically where all the funds of the condo fees get put into. And as maintenance and different upkeep needs to be completed on the building, on the structure, then that's what they dig into. You just don't want to have somebody that double dips or dips into it for their own personal use. These are things.
Well, I haven't seen that, but what I have seen is they'll advertise condos and they'll say, well, our condo fees are only $40 a month. And I'm thinking, well, that's great. As far as the sales pitch is concerned, it's great for you selling the condos. But down the road, where's the cash going to come for the maintenance of common areas?
Yeah, but I have seen it.
Seen what?
I'm aware of misuse of the reserve funds for personal use.
No way.
100%. So you want to make sure you know, because you'll be the one, if you're buying into this condo, buying into, unfortunately, this mismanaged business.
In closing, just a couple of points. If you're emailing an agent, I had one there a few days ago. We want to list your house. No phone number, no information. Ask them questions. They were very, how would you say it? They didn't answer the questions in their complete form. They missed one question. I've got no phone number. I mean, how seriously can you take somebody like this? And it's not because you're trying to ignore them. It's just a lot better just to pick up the phone and have a conversation than play email tag for 3 weeks. Would you agree?
Mm-hmm.
Other things, if you are, and I'm sure you must get these on a daily basis, on realtor.ca, you can email the agent for more information, and there's a little area there where you can comment. It would really be helpful if you did have specific questions or particular information you're looking for to indicate that in the email, because to send an email, it just says, I'm looking for more information, and probably no phone number on there either, is not really helpful.
No, it's not helpful. And sometimes you will get that I'm working with, you know, this realtor, this agent. Please know your agent should be able to get all that information and answer your questions. I know the mindset out there can be, well, it's the listing agent's job. I don't want to bother my agent. I'm going to do my own due diligence and research, and then I'll let my agent know which one I pick. The listing agent's responsibility is to collect all the information, create an attractive marketing representation, market that property, get it out there, and represent their seller.
And represent the seller, and not represent the buyer.
Exactly.
So they're not going to send you information that would be contradictory to marketing that property and showing it in the best light. Whereas your information, if you're dealing with a buyer's agent that's experienced, they will share information with you that you probably want to know about. For instance, there's a new nuclear power plant going up next door. This is something the listing agent should disclose, but may not.
Yeah, again, it's so easy to sit on your couch at home with your tablet on your lap. You click the little button, I want more information.
The agent on the other end clicks the little button that says delete.
No.
I know a lot of them do.
But we get a lot of those. So to receive as a listing agent, especially if you're predominantly a listing agent with a healthy supply of real estate inventory, that takes hours of your day just to respond to inquiries that are probably not going to turn into anything. So you're going to find, well, that agent never gets back to me. Well, it's probably because they have 10, 12, 20 of those a day, and they have other serious clients that, whether they're representing them as a buyer's agent or a seller agent, they're going to go with that, those inquiries that they know with their custom collaboration, marketing properties, getting it out there. They're going to work with those individuals. So don't take offense. Just find an agent that is going to represent you, have a buyer's agreement signed with them, and send all your inquiries to them. They'll be more than happy, I am so confident, to put together extensive packages, give you lots of detailed information, and follow up with you afterwards to see if you have any further questions.
With your permission, I'll let you wrap it up.
Thanks for listening again to another episode of the Michael and Patty Show, otherwise known as MAPS. And if this is your first episode that you've listened to, just know it. Our podcast is filled with, hopefully, valuable to you information to help you with the buying and selling experience here on Prince Edward Island, and a lot of extra little tidbits and facts about PEI as well. Thanks for listening. And again, we appreciate each and every one of you for tuning in.
Be sure to follow or subscribe to the podcast. We'd really appreciate it if you left us a 5-star rating and any feedback. And if there's anything you would like us to cover on PEI Real Estate or just Prince Edward Island in general, shoot Patty or I a note. Thanks, and have a great day.
Have a great day.